Chapter 11. Shigek. If all human events possess purpose, then all human deeds possess purpose. And yet, when men vie with men, the purpose of no man comes to fruition. The result always falls somewhere in between. The purpose of deeds, then, cannot derive from the purposes of men, because all men vie with all men. This means the deeds of men must be willed by something other than men. From this it follows that we are all slaves. Who then is our master? Memgawa, the Book of Divine Acts. What is practicality but one moment betrayed for the next? Triamus the First, Journals and Dialogues. Late Summer, 4111, Year of the Tusk, Southern Gedea. Gedea didn't so much end as vanish. After dozens of skirmishes and petty sieges, Coithus Athgieri and his knights raced south across the vast sandstone plateau of the Gedean interior. They followed ravines and ridge lines, always climbing. By day, they hunted antelope for food and jackals for sport. At night, they could smell the great desert on the wind. The grasses faltered, gave way to dust, gravel, and pungent-smelling scrub. After riding 3 full days without seeing so much as a goat herd, they finally sighted smoke on the southern horizon. They hastened up the slopes, only to rein their caparisoned mounts to a sudden and panicked halt. The ground plummeted 1,000 feet or more. To either side, great escarpments ramped into the hazy distances. Before them, the long waters of the river Sempis snaked across a plain of verdant green, its back flashing opposite the sun. Shigek. The ancient Kyrenians had called her Kemerat, the Red Land, because of the copper-colored silt the seasonal floods deposited across the plains. In far antiquity, she ruled an empire that extended from Sumna to Shima, and her god-kings produced works unrivaled to this day, including the legendary ziggurats. In near antiquity, she was famed for the subtlety of her priests, the elegance of her perfumes, and the effectiveness of her poisons. For the men of the Tusk, she was a land of curses, crypts, and uneasy ruins, a place where the past became dread, it ran so deep. Athgieri and his knights descended the escarpments and wondered that sterile desert could so quickly become lush fields and heavy trees. Wary of ambush, they followed the ancient dikes, rode through one abandoned village, then another. Finally, they found one old man without fear, and with some difficulty determined that Scaudus and all the Kianin had abandoned the north bank. Hence the smoke they had seen from the escarpment. The Sapatasha was burning every boat he could find. The young Earl of Gainry sent word to the great names. 2 weeks later, the first columns of the Holy War marched unopposed into the Sempis Valley. Bands of Enrithi spread across the floodplain, securing stores, occupying the villas and strongholds abandoned by the Kianin. There was little bloodshed, at first. Along the river, the men of the Tusk saw sacred ibis and heron wading among the reeds, and great flocks of egret wheeling over the black waters. Some even glimpsed crocodiles and hippopotamuses, beasts which, they would learn, the Shigeki revered as holy. Away from the river, where small stands of various trees, eucalyptus and sycamore, date palm and fan palm, perpetually screened the distances, they were often surprised by ruined foundations, by pillars and walls bearing engravings of nameless kings and their forgotten conquests. Some of the ruins were truly colossal, the remains of palace or temple complexes once as great, it seemed to them, as the Andiamine Heights in Momum or the Junrayuma in Holy Sumna. Many of them wandered for a time, pondering things that may or may not have happened. When they passed villages, walking along earthen banks meant to capture floodwaters for the fields, the inhabitants gathered to watch them, shushing children and holding tight barking dogs. In the centuries following the Kianin conquest, the Shigeki had become devout Fainim, but they were an old race, tenants who had always outlived their landlords. They could no longer recognize themselves in the warlike images that glared from the broken walls. So beer, wine, and water were given to slake the invaders' thirst. Onions, dates, and fresh-baked breads were furnished to sate his hunger, and sometimes daughters were offered to comfort his lust. Incredulous, the men of the Tusk shook their heads and exclaimed that this was a land of marvels, and some were reminded of their first youthful visit to their father's ancestral home, of that strange sense of returning to a place where they had never been. Shygek was oft named in the tractate, the rumor of a distant tyrant already ancient in those ancient days. As a result, some among the Enrithi found themselves troubled because the word seemed to overshoot the place. They urinated in the river, defecated in the trees, and slapped at the mosquitoes. The ground was old, melancholy, more fertile perhaps, but it was ground like any other ground. Most, however, found themselves struck by awe. No matter how sacred the text, the words merely dangled when the lands remained unseen. Each in their own way, they realized that pilgrimage was the work of stitching the world to scripture. They had taken their first true step, and Holy Shaima seemed so close. Then Kerjula, the Tidoni Earl of Wornut, encountered the walled town of Chiama. Fearing starvation because of a blight the previous year, the town elders demanded guarantees before throwing open their gates. Rather than negotiate, Kerjula simply ordered his men to storm the walls, which were easily overcome. Once within, the Wornutishmen butchered everyone. 2 days afterward, there was another massacre at Jiruks, the great river fortress opposite the south bank city of Emignatus. Apparently, the Shigeki garrison left there by Scaurus had mutinied and murdered all their Kianine officers. When Uranyanka, the famed Enanai Palatine of Mazarathu, arrived with his knights, the mutineers threw open the gates only to be herded together and executed en masse. Heathens, Uranyanka would later tell Keferamuni, he could tolerate, but treacherous heathens he could not forbear. The following morning, Gedeki, the tempestuous Palatine of Anplay, ordered the assault of a town called Hutterat, not too far from the old dynasty city of Iothea, presumably because his interpreter, a notorious drunkard, had mistranslated the town's terms of surrender. Once the gates were taken, his Kunrayans ran amok through the streets, raping and murdering without discrimination. Then, as though murder possessed its own unholy momentum, the Holy War's occupation of the North Bank degenerated into wanton carnage, though for what reason, no one knew. Perhaps it was the rumors of poisoned dates and pomegranates. Perhaps bloodshed simply begat bloodshed. Perhaps faith's certainty was as terrifying as it was beautiful. What could be more true than destroying the false? Word of the Enrithi atrocities spread among the Shigeki. Before the altar and in the streets, the priests of Fane claimed that the solitary god punished them for welcoming the idolaters. The Shigeki began barricading themselves in their great domed tabernacles. With their wives and children they gathered, wailing on the soft carpets, crying out their sins, begging for forgiveness. The thunder of rams at the doors would be their only answer. Then the rush of iron-eyed swordsmen. Every tabernacle across the North Bank witnessed some kind of massacre. The men of the Tusk hacked the screaming penitents into silence. Then they kicked over the tripods, smashed the marmoreal altars, tore the tapestries from the walls and the grand kneeling rugs from the floors. Anything carrying the taint of Fainimry they heaved into colossal bonfires. Sometimes, beneath the rugs, they found the breathtaking mosaics of the Enrithi who had originally raised the temple, and the structure would be spared. Otherwise, the great Fainim tabernacles of Shygek were burned. Beneath monstrous towers of smoke, dogs nosed the heaped dead and licked blood from the broad steps. In Iothea, which had thrown open her gates in terror, hundreds of Karathotics, an Enrithi sect that had managed to survive centuries of Fainim oppression, saved themselves by singing the ancient hymns of the Thousand Temples. Men who had wailed in terror suddenly found themselves embracing the long-lost brothers of their faith. That night, the Karathotics took to the streets, kicking down doors, murdering old competitors, unscrupulous tax farmers, anyone they had begrudged under the Sapatashah's regime. Their grudges were many. In red-walled Nagagris, the men of the Tusk actually began slaughtering one another. Almost as soon as the Holy War had arrived in Shigek, the Shigeki potentates remaining in the city sent emissaries to Ikuri Confis, offering to surrender to the emperor in exchange for imperial protection. Confis promptly dispatched General Numomarius and a cohort of Kidrahil. Through some unexplained blunder, however, the gates were relinquished to a large force of Thunieri, fierce Ingrawlish, and Skogwomen for the most part, who promptly began plundering the city. The Kidrahil attempted to intervene, and pitched battles broke out in the streets. When General Numomarius met with Yalgrota Srankamer under flag of truce, the giant brained him. Disorganized by the death of their general and unnerved by the ferocity of the blonde-bearded warriors, the Kidrahil withdrew from the city. But none suffered more horribly than the Fenic priests. At night, around fires of heathen reliquary, the Enrithi used them for drunken sport, slicing open their bellies, leading them like mules by their own entrails. Some were blinded, some strangled, some were forced to watch their wives and daughters raped. Others were flayed alive. A great many were burned as witches. Scarcely a village could be found without the mutilated corpse of some Fenic priest or functionary nailed to the vaulting limbs of a eucalyptus tree. 2 weeks passed, then suddenly, as though some precise measure had been exacted, the madness lifted. In the end, only a fraction of the Shigeki population had been killed, but no traveler could pass more than an hour without crossing paths with the dead. Instead of the humble boats of fishermen and traders, bloated corpses bobbed down the defiled waters of the Sempus and fanned out across the Menonor Sea. At long last, Shigek had been cleansed. From the summit, the ziggurat seemed far steeper than it had from the ground below, but then so did most things, after the fact. Cresting the last of the treacherous steps, Kellis turned to the surrounding vista. To the north and west, all was cultivation. He saw diked fields, lines of sycamore and ash, and villages that looked like mounds of shattered pottery in the distance. Several smaller ziggurats reared in the near distance, staunch and stolid, anchoring a network of channels and embankments that reached out to the hazy Gideon escarpments. To the south, past the shoulders of the ziggurat a Commune had called Palpothis, he saw stands of marsh ginkgos standing like bent sentinels amid thickets of sandbar willows. The mighty Sempus glittered in the sunlight beyond, and to the east, he saw lines of red through green, raised footpaths and ancient roadways, passing beneath shadowy copses and between sunny fields, all converging on Iothea, which darkened the horizon with her walls and smoke. Shigek, yet another ancient land. So old and so vast, Father. Did you see it thus? He glanced down the stair that formed a causeway across the ziggurat's mammoth back, saw a Commune still laboring up the steps. Sweat darkened the armpits and collar of his white linen tunic. I thought you said the ancients believed their gods lived atop these things, Kellis called down. Why do you tarry? A Commune paused, scowled up at the remaining distance. Gasping for breath, he struggled to smile through his grimace. Because the ancients believed their gods lived atop these things. Kellis grinned, then turned to study the wrecked summit. The ancient godhouse lay in shambles, ruined walls and spilled blocks. He inspected sundered engravings and indecipherable pictograms, the remains of gods, he imagined, and their earthly invocations. Faith. Faith had raised this black-stepped mountain, the beliefs of long-dead men. So much, Father, and all in the name of delusion. It scarcely seemed possible, and yet the Holy War wasn't so different. In some ways, it was a far greater, if more ephemeral, work. In the months since arriving at Momum, Kellis had laid the foundation of his own ziggurat, insinuating himself into the confidence of the mighty, instilling the suspicion that he was more, far more, than the prince he claimed to be. With a reluctance proper to wisdom and humility, he'd finally assumed the role others had thrust upon him. Given the complexities involved, he had initially hoped to proceed with more caution, but his encounter with Sarcellus had forced him to accelerate his timetable, to take risks he would have otherwise avoided. Even now, he knew the consult watched him, studied him, and pondered his growing power. He had to seize the holy war before their patience dwindled too far. He had to make a ziggurat of these men.
You saw them too, didn't you, Father? Is it you they hunt? Are they the reason you summoned me?
Looking across the near distance, he saw a man walking with his oxen along a raised pathway, flicking them with his switch every third or fourth step. He saw backs bent in neighboring fields of millet. A half mile away, he saw a party of Enrithi horsemen riding in single file through yellowing wheat. Any one of them could be a consult spy.
Sweet Seja,
a Commian cried as he gained the summit. What would the sorcerer do if he learned of his secret conflict with a consult? The mandate couldn't be involved, Kellis knew, not until he possessed power enough to parley with them as equals. Everything came to power.
What's this called again?
Kellis asked, though he forgot nothing.
The Great Ziggurat of Zyjoser,
a Commian replied, still panting.
One of the mightiest works of the old dynasty. Remarkable, isn't it?
Yes, Kellis said with false, forced enthusiasm.
He must feel shame. Something troubles you,
a Commian asked, leaning against his knees. He turned to spit over the summit's edge.
Serwe,
Kellis said with an air of admission. Tell me, would you think her capable of being... He feigned a nervous swallow. A Commian looked away to the hazy landscape, but not before Kellis glimpsed a fleeting expression of terror. Palms turning upward, nervous stroke of his beard, flaring heart rate.
Being what?
The sorcerer asked with sham disinterest. Of all the souls Kellis had mastered, few had proven as useful as Serwe. Lust and shame were ever the shortest paths to the hearts of world-born men. Ever since he'd sent her to a Commian, the sorcerer had compensated for his half-remembered trespass in innumerable subtle ways. The old Kunryan proverb was true. No friend was more generous than the one who has seduced your wife. And generosity was precisely what he needed from Drusus Akamian.
Nothing,
Kellis said with a shake of his head. All men fear their women venal, I suppose. Some openings must be continually worked and worried, while others must be left to fester. Avoiding his gaze, the schoolman groaned and rubbed his lower back.
I'm getting too old for this,
he said with anxious good humor. He cleared his throat and spit one final time.
How Esme would crow.
Esmenet, she too had a part to play. After so many weeks of prolonged contact, Kellis had come to know a Commian far better than a Commian knew himself. Those who loved the schoolman, Zynemus and Esmenet, often thought him weak. They softened hard words, pretended not to notice the unsteady hands or the fragile expressions, and they spoke with an almost parental defensiveness on his behalf. But Drusus Akamian, Kellis knew, was stronger than anyone, especially Drusus Akamian, suspected. Some men frittered themselves away with incessant doubt and reflection, until it seemed they had no shape they could grasp hold of. Some men had to be hewed by the crude axe of the world, tested.
Tell me, Kellis said. How much must a teacher give?
He knew that a Commian had long since stopped thinking himself his teacher, but the sorcerer was just vain enough not to disabuse him of this impression. The most powerful flatteries dwelt not in what was said, but in the assumptions behind what was said.
That, a Commian replied, daring his gaze once again, depends upon the student.
So the student must be known to prevent giving too little. He must question himself.
Or too much.
This was an intellectual habit of Akamian's, noting the importance of contrary and not so obvious things. He delighted in throwing aside the veil, in revealing the complexities that lurked beneath simple things. In this, he was almost unique. World-born men, Kellis had found, despised complexity as much as they cherished flattery. Most men would rather die in deception than live in uncertainty.
Too much, Kellis repeated. You mean like Proyas?
A Commian glanced to his sandaled feet.
Yes, like Proyas.
What did you teach him?
What we call the exoterics, logic, history, arithmetic,
Everything save the esoterics. Sorcery. And that was too much? The sorcerer paused in puzzlement, suddenly unsure as to what he'd meant.
No, he conceded after a moment. I guess not. I had hoped to teach him doubt, tolerance, but the clamor of his faith was too great. Perhaps if they'd let me finish his education. But he's lost. Another man of the tusk.
Now show him ease.
Kellis snorted in a half laugh. Like me.
Exactly, the mandate schoolman said, grinning in the both sly and shy way that others, Kellis had noted, found so endearing. Another bloodthirsty fanatic.
Kellis laughed Zynemus's laugh, then trailed, smiling. For some time he'd been mapping Akamian's responses to the finer nuances of his expression. Though Kellis had never met Inrau, he knew, with startling exactitude, the peculiarities of the young man's manner and expression, so well that he could prompt Akamian to thoughts of Inrau with little more than a look or a smile. Paro Inrau, the student Akamian had lost in Sumna, the student he'd failed.
There's more than one kind of fanaticism, Kellis said.
The sorcerer's eyes widened momentarily, then narrowed in anxious thoughts of Inrau and the events of the previous year, things he'd rather not remember.
The mandate must become more than a hated master. They must become an enemy.
But not all fanaticisms are equal, Akamian said.
How do you mean? Not equal in principle, or not equal in consequence?
Inrau was such a consequence, as were the countless thousands the Holy War had murdered over the past several days. Your school, Kellis had suggested, is no different.
The truth, Akamian said.
The truth distinguishes them. No matter what the fanaticism, Enrithi, consult, or even mandate, the consequences are the same. Men die or suffer. The question is one of what they die or suffer for.
So purpose, true purpose, justifies suffering, even death?
You must believe as much, otherwise you wouldn't be here. Kellis smiled as though abashed at having been exposed.
So it all comes to truth. If one's purposes are true,
anything can be justified. Any torment, any murder.
Kellis rounded his eyes the way he knew Inrau would.
Any betrayal, he said. Akamian stared, his nimble face as stony as he could manage. But Kellis saw past the dark skin, past the sheath of fine muscle, past even the soul that toiled beneath. He saw arcana and anguish, a yearning steeped in 3,000 years of wisdom. He saw a child beaten and bullied by a drunken father. He saw 100 generations of Enroni fishermen pinioned between hunger and the cruel sea. He saw Seswatha and the madness of war without hope. He saw ancient Ketche tribesmen surge down mountain slopes. He saw the animal, rooting and rutting, reaching back to time out of memory. He didn't see what came after. He saw what came before.
Any betrayal, the sorcerer repeated dully. He is close.
And your cause, Kellis pressed, the prevention of the second apocalypse, is true. There can be no doubt.
So in the name of that cause, you can commit any act, any betrayal?
Akamian's eyes slackened in dread, and Kellis glimpsed a worry too fleet to become a question. The schoolmen had become accustomed to the efficiency of their discourse. Rarely had they ever wandered from question to question as they did now.
It's strange, Akamian said. The way things spoken with assurance by one can sound so outrageous when repeated by another.
An unanticipated turn, but an opportunity as well. A shorter path.
It troubles, Kellis said, because it shows that conviction is as cheap as words. Any man can believe unto death. Any man can claim your claim.
So you fear I'm no different from any other fanatic?
Wouldn't you?
How deep does his conviction go?
You are the harbinger, Kellis. If you dreamed Seswatha's dream as I did, but couldn't Proyas say the same of his fanaticism? Couldn't he say, if you spoke to Mathanet as I did?
How far would he follow it? To the death?
The sorcerer sighed and nodded. That's always the dilemma now, isn't it?
But whose dilemma, mine or yours? Would he follow it beyond? Akamian laughed, but in the clipped manner of men who make light of what horrifies them. It's the world's dilemma, Kellis.
I need more than that, Akka, more than bald assertions.
Would he follow it all the way?
I'm not sure.
What is it you want of me?
Kellis exclaimed in sudden desperation. Inrao's indecision warbled through his voice. Inrao's horror pulled wide his eyes.
I must have it.
The sorcerer stared, horror-stricken.
Kellis, I—
Think of what you're telling me. Think, Akka, think. You're saying that I'm the sign of the second apocalypse, that I augur mankind's extinction.
But of course Akamian thought him more.
No, Kellis, not the end.
Then what am I? Just what do you think I am?
I think you may be—
What, Akka, what?
Everything has a purpose,
the schoolman cried in exasperation.
You've come to me for a reason, even if you've yet to embrace it.
This, Kellis knew, was false. For events to have purpose, their ends had to determine their beginnings, and this was impossible. Things were governed by their origins, not their destinations. What came before determined what came after. His manipulation of these world-born men was proof enough of that. If the Dunyane had been mistaken in their theorems, their axioms remained inviolate. The Logos had been complicated, nothing more. Even sorcery, from what he'd gleaned, followed laws.
And what purpose is that? Kellis asked.
Akamian hesitated, and though he remained utterly silent, everything from his expression to his scent to his pulse howled in panic. He licked his lips.
I think to save the world.
Always it came to this, always the same delusion.
So I'm your cause?
Kellis said incredulously.
I'm the truth that justifies your fanaticism?
Akamian could only stare in dread. Plundering the man's expression, Kellis watched the inferences splash and trickle through his soul, drawn of their own weight to a single inexorable conclusion. Everything, by his own admission. He must yield everything. Even the Gnosis. How powerful have you become, Father? Without warning, Akamian stood and started down the monumental stair. He took each step with weary deliberation, as though counting them. The Shigeki wind tousled his shining black hair. When Kellis called to him, he said only, I tire of the heights, as Kellis had known he would. General Martimus had always considered himself a practical man. He was someone who always clarified his tasks, then methodically set about achieving his goals. He had no birthright, no pampered childhood to cloud his judgment. He simply saw, appraised, and acted. The world was not so complicated, he would tell his junior officers, so long as one remained clear-headed and ruthlessly practical. See, appraise, act. He had lived his life by this philosophy. How easily it had been defeated. The task had seemed straightforward, if somewhat unusual, in the beginning. Watch Prince Anasarimber Kellis of Atrathau and attempt to gain his confidence. If the man collected followers to some insidious purpose, as Confis suspected, then an answer general suffering a crisis of faith should have proven an irresistible opportunity. It did not. Martimus had attended at least a dozen of his evening sermons, or imprompta, as they were calling them, before the man had even acknowledged him with a single word. Of course, Confis, who always faulted his executors before his assumptions, had held Martimus responsible. There could be no doubt Kellis was Kisharim, because he was connected to Skaeus, who was indubitably Kisharim. There could be no doubt the man played the prophet, not after the incident with Sauban. And there could be no way the man knew that Martimus was bait, since Confis had told no one of his plan other than Martimus. Therefore, Martimus had failed, even if Martimus was too obstinate to see this for himself. But this was merely one of innumerable petty injustices Confis had foisted on him over the years. Even if Martimus had cared to take insult, which was unlikely, he was far too busy being afraid. He wasn't quite sure when it happened, but at some point during the long march across Gedea,
General Martimus, as eminently practical as he was, had ceased believing that Prince Kellis played the prophet. This didn't mean he thought the man was, in fact, a prophet. Martimus remained practical in that respect, only that he no longer knew what he believed. But soon he would, and the prospect terrified him. Martimus was also an intensely loyal man, and he treasured his position as Icuri Confis's aide-de-camp. He often thought he'd been born to serve under the mercurial exalt general, to balance the man's undeniable brilliance with more sober, more dependable observations. "The prodigy must be reminded of the practical," he would often think. No matter how delectable the spices, one could not do without salt. But if Kellis was in fact, what happened to his loyalty then? Martimus pondered this while sitting among the steaming thousands who'd gathered to hear Prince Kellis's first sermon since the madness of reaching Shigek. Before him loomed ancient Zyjoser, the great ziggurat, a mountain of corniced and polished black stone, so massive it seemed he should cover his face and fall to his belly. The luxuriant plains of the Sempus Delta swept out in either direction, embellished by lesser ziggurats, waterways, reed marshes, and endless rice paddies. The sun flared white in desert skies. Throughout the crowds, men and women talked and laughed. For a time, Martimus watched the couple before him share a humble repast of onions and bread. Then he realized those sitting around him were taking care to avoid his look. His uniform and blue cloak probably frightened them, he thought, made him appear a caste noble. He looked from neighbor to distracted neighbor, trying to think of something he might say to set them at ease, but he couldn't bring himself to utter the first word. A profound loneliness struck him. He thought of Confis once again. Then he saw Prince Kellis, small and distant, descending Zyjoser's monumental stair. Martimus smiled, as though finding an old friend in a foreign market. What will he say? When he first started attending the Imprompta, Martimus had assumed the talks would be either heretical or easily dismissed. They were neither. Indeed, Prince Kellis recited the words of the old prophets and of Inri Sejanus as though they were his own. Nothing of what he said contradicted any of the innumerable sermons Martimus had heard over the course of his life, though those sermons often contradicted one another. It was as though the prince pursued further truths, the unspoken implications of what all Orthodox in Rethi already believed. To listen to him, it seemed, was to learn what one already knew without knowing. The Prince of God, some called him, he who sheds light within. His white silk robes shining in the sunlight, Prince Kellis paused on the ziggurat's lower steps and looked over the restless masses. There was something glorious about his aspect, as though he'd descended not from the heights but from the heavens. With a flutter of dread, Martimus realized he never saw the man ascend the ziggurat, nor even step from the ruin of the ancient godhouse upon its summit. He had just noticed him. The general cursed himself for a fool. "The prophet Angeshriel," Prince Kellis called, "came down from his fast on Mount Eshki." The assembly fell absolutely silent, so much so that Martimus could hear the breeze buffet his ears. "Husyelt, the tusk tells us, sent a hare to him so he might eat at last. And Geshriel skinned the hunter's gift and struck a fire so he might feast. When he had eaten and was content, sacred Husyelt, the holy stalker, joined him at his fire, for the gods in those days had not left the world in the charge of men. And Geshriel, recognizing the god as the god, fell immediately to his knees before the fire, not thinking where he would throw his face." The prince suddenly grinned. "Like a young man on his wedding night, he erred in his eagerness." Martimus laughed with a thousand others. Somehow the sun flashed brighter. "And the god said, 'Why does our prophet fall to his knees only? Are not prophets men like other men? Should they not throw their faces to the earth?' To which Angeshriel replied, 'I find my fire before me.' And peerless Husyelt said, 'The fire burns across earth, and what fire consumes becomes earth. I am your god,
throw your face to the earth.
The prince paused.
So Angeshriel, the tusk tells us, bowed his head into the flames.
Despite the close, humid air, Martimus's skin pimpled. How many times, especially as a child, had he stared into some fire, struck by the errant thought of plunging his face into the flames, if only to feel what a prophet once felt? Angeshriel, the burnt prophet, he lowered his face into fire. Fire!
Like Angeshriel, the prince continued, we find ourselves kneeling before just such a fire.
Martimus caught his breath. Heat flared through him, or so it seemed.
Truth!
Prince Kellis cried, as though calling out a name that every man recognized.
The fire of truth! The truth of who you are!
Somehow his voice had divided, become a chorus.
You are frail. You are alone. Those who would love you know you not. You lust for obscene things. You fear even your closest brother. You understand far less than you pretend. You are these things. Frail, alone, unknown, lusting, fearing, and uncomprehending. Even now, you can feel these truths burn. Even now,
he raised a hand as though to further quiet silent men,
they consume you.
He lowered his hand.
But you do not throw your face to the earth. You do not...
His glittering eyes fell upon Martimus, who felt his throat tighten, felt the small finishing hammer of his heart tap, 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 blood to his face.
He sees through me. He witnesses.
But why?
The prince asked, his timbre bruised by an old and baffling pain.
In the anguish of this fire lies the god, and in the god lies redemption.
Each of you holds the key to your own redemption. You already kneel before it, but still you do not throw your face to the earth. You are frail. You are alone. Those who love you know you not. You lust for obscene things. You fear even your closest brother, and you understand far less than you pretend.
Martimus grimaced. The words had drawn a pain from his bowels to the back of his throat and sent his thoughts reeling in giddy recognition of something at once familiar and estranged.
Me. He speaks of me.
Is there any among you who would deny this?
Silence. Somewhere someone wept.
But you do deny this, Prince Kellis cried, like a lover confronted by an impossible infidelity. All of you! You kneel, but you also cheat. Cheat the fire of your own heart. You give breath to lie after lie, clamor that this fire is not the truth, that you are strong, that you are not alone, that those who love you do know you, that you lust not for obscene things, that you fear not your brother in any way, that you understand everything.
How many times had Martimus lied thus? Martimus, the practical man, Martimus, the realistic man. How could he be these things if he knew so well of what Prince Kellis spoke?
But in the secret moments, yes, the secret moments, these denials ring hollow, do they not? In the secret moments you glimpse the anguish of truth. In the secret moments you see that your life has been a mummer's farce, and you weep, and you ask, what is wrong? And you cry out, why cannot I be strong?
He leapt down several steps.
Why cannot I be strong?
Martimus's throat ached as though he himself had bawled these words.
Because, the prince said softly, you lie.
And Martimus thought madly, skin and hair, he's just a man.
You are frail because you feign strength.
The voice was disembodied now, and it whispered secretly into a thousand flushed ears.
You are alone because you lie ceaselessly. Those who love you do not know you because you are a mummer. You lust for obscene things because you deny that you lust. You fear your brother because you fear what he sees. You understand little because you learn you must admit you know nothing.
How could a life be cupped into a single palm?
Do you see the tragedy? The prince implored. The scriptures bid us to be godlike, to be more than what we are. And what are we?
frail men with peevish hearts, envious hearts, choked by the shroud of our own lies, men who remain frail because they cannot confess their frailty. And this word, frail, seemed pitched down from the heavens, from the outside, and for an instant, the man who'd spoken it was no longer a man, but the earthly surface of something far greater. Frail, spoken not from the lips of a man, but from somewhere else. And Martimus understood. I sit in the presence of the god. Horror and bliss, chafing his eyes, blinding his skin everywhere. The presence of the god. To at last be still, to be braced by that which braced the very world, and to see at long last how far one had plummeted. And it seemed to Martimus that he was here for the first time, as though one could only truly be oneself, be here, in the clearing that was God. Here. The impossibility of drawing sweet air through salty lips, the mystery of moving soul in furtive intellect, the grace of thronging passions, the impossibility, the miracle of here. Kneel with me, a voice from nowhere said. Take my hand and do not fear. Throw your face into the furnace. A place had been prepared for these final words, words that traced the scripture of his heart. A place of rapture. The multitude cried out, and Martimus cried with them. Some openly wept, and Martimus wept with them. Others reached out as though trying to clutch his image. Martimus raised two fingers to brush his distant face. How long Prince Kellis spoke, he couldn't say. But he spoke of many things, and upon whatever ground his word set foot, the world was transformed. What does it mean to be a warrior? Is not war the fire, the furnace? Is not war the very truth of our frailty? He even taught them a hymn, which, he said, had come to him in a dream, and the song moved them the way only a song from the outside could move them, a hymn sung by the very gods. For the rest of his days, Martimus would awaken and hear that song. And afterward, when the masses thronged about the prince, fell to their knees and softly kissed the hem of his white robe, he bid them to stand, reminded them that he was just a man, like other men. And at long last, when the crush of bodies delivered Martimus to him, the surreal blue eyes regarded him gently, glanced not at all at his golden cuirass, his blue cloak, or the insignia of his station. I have waited for you, General. The excited rumble of others grew distant, as though the two of them had been submerged. Martimus could only stare, dumbstruck, overawed, and so gratified. Confis sent you, but that has changed now, hasn't it? And Martimus felt a child before his father, unable to lie, unable to speak the truth. The prophet nodded as though he had spoken. What will happen to your loyalty, I wonder? Somewhere distant, almost too far to touch, men cried out. Martimus watched the prophet turn his head, reach back with a golden haloed hand, and seize a flying arm, which bore a fist, which gripped a long and silvery knife. Assassination, he thought without concern. The man before him couldn't be killed. He knew that now. The mobs pummeled the assassin to the earth. Martimus glimpsed a bloodied, howling face. The prophet turned back to him. I would not divide your heart, he said. Come to me again when you are ready.
I'm warning you, Proyas. Something must be done about this man.
Icuri Confis had said this somewhat more emphatically than he'd intended. But then these were emphatic times. The Conryan prince reclined in his camp chair and looked at him blandly. He picked at his trim beard with an absent hand. What do you suggest? Finally.
That we convene a full council of the greater and lesser names.
And?
That we bring charges against him.
Proyas frowned. Charges? What charges?
Under the auspices of the Tusk, the old law.
Ah, I see. And what would you charge Prince Kellis with?
With fomenting blasphemy, with pretensions to prophecy.
Proyas nodded. In other words, he said scathingly, with being a false prophet. Confis laughed incredulously. He could remember once, long ago it now seemed, thinking he and Proyas would become fast and famous friends over the course of the Holy War.
They were both handsome, they were close in age, and in their respective corners of the three seas, they were considered prodigies of similar promise. That was until his obliteration of the Skilvendi at the Battle of Caiuth. I have no peers.
Could any charge be more appropriate? Confis asked.
I agreed, Proyas replied testily, to discuss ways of surprising Scorus on the south bank, not to discuss the piety of a man I consider to be my friend. Although Proyas's pavilion was large and richly outfitted, it was both gloomy and intolerably hot. Unlike the others, who had traded their canvas for the marble of abandoned villas, Proyas maintained himself as though still on the march, only a fanatic.
"You've heard of these sermons at Zyjoza?"
Confis asked, thinking, "Martimus, you fool." But then that was the problem. Martimus wasn't a fool. Confis could scarce imagine anyone less foolish. That was precisely the problem.
"Yes, yes," Proyas replied with an exasperated breath.
"I've been invited to attend on a number of occasions, but the field keeps me busy."
"I imagine. Did you know that many among the rank and file, my men, your men, refer to him as the warrior prophet?" "The warrior prophet?"
"Yes, I know this as well."
Proyas said this with the same air of indulgent impatience as before, but his brows knitted together as if pinching a troubling thought.
"As it stands," Confis said, speaking as though at the limits of his good humor, "this is the holy war of the latter prophet, of Inri Sejanus. But if this fraud continues to gather followers, it will fast become the holy war of the warrior prophet. Do you understand?"
Dead prophets were useful, because one could rule in their name, but live prophets? Kishorim prophets? Perhaps I should tell him what happened with Scaeus. Proyas shook his head in weary dismissal.
"What would you have me do, eh, Confis? Kellis is unlike other men. There's no doubt about that, and he does have these dreams. But he makes no claim to be a prophet, and he's angered when others call him so."
"So what? So he must first admit to being a false prophet? Being a false prophet, in fact, isn't enough."
His expression pained. Proyas regarded him narrowly, looked him up and down as though assessing the appropriateness of his field armor.
"Why does this concern you so, Confis? You're most assuredly not a pious man."
"What would you have me do, uncle? Should I tell him?"
Confis suppressed the urge to spit like the Skilvendi, ran his tongue over his teeth instead. He despised indecision.
"The question of my piety is not the concern here."
Proyas drew in and released a heavy breath.
"I've sat long hours with a man, Confis. Together we've read aloud from the Chronicle of the Tusk and the Tractate, and not once in all that time have I detected the merest whisper of heresy. In fact, Kellis is perhaps the most deeply pious man I've ever met. Now, the fact that others have begun calling him prophet is disturbing, I agree, but it is not his doing. People are weak, Confis. Is it so surprising that they look to him and see his strength for more than what it is?"
Confis felt sweet disdain unfold across his face.
"Even you. He's ensnared even you."
What kind of man? Though he was loath to admit it, his briefing with Martimus had shook him deeply. Somehow, over a matter of mere weeks, this Prince Kellis had managed to reduce his most dependable man to a babbling idiot.
Truth, the frailty of men, the furnace.
What nonsense! And yet nonsense that was seeping through the holy war like blood through linen. This Prince Kellis was a wound, and if he was in fact a Kishorim spy, as dear old Uncle Zarias feared, he could well prove mortal. Proyas was angered and answered disdain with disdain.
"Ensnaring," he snorted. "Of course you would see it as such. Men of ambition never understand the pious. For them, goals must be worldly in order to be sensible, solutions to base hungers."
There was something forced, Confis decided, about these words. "I've planted a seed, at least."
"There's much to be said for being well-fed,"
Confis snapped, then turned on his heel. He'd exceeded his daily ration of idiots. Proyas's voice halted him before the curtains.
"One last thing, Exalt General."
Confis turned, lids low, eyebrows raised.
"Yes?"
You've heard of the attempt on Prince Kellis's life. You mean there's another sober man in this world?
Proyas smiled sourly. For a moment, real hatred flashed in his eyes.
Prince Kellis tells me the man who tried to kill him was Nansour, one of your officers, in fact.
Confis stared at the man blankly, realizing he'd been duped. All those questions, Proyas had asked them in order to implicate him, to see whether he had motive.
Confis cursed himself for a fool. Fanatic or not, Nersey Proyas was not a man to be underestimated. This is becoming a nightmare.
What? Confis said. You propose to arrest me?
You propose to arrest Prince Kellis.
Confis grinned.
You would find it hard to arrest an army.
I see no army, Proyas said.
Confis smiled.
But you do.
Of course, there was nothing Proyas could do, even if the assassin had survived, to name Confis directly. The Holy War needed the Empire. Even still, there was a lesson to be learned. War was intellect. Confis would teach this Prince Kellis that... His loitering Kidrahil snapped to attention as Confis exited the pavilion. As a precaution, he'd taken some 200 of the heavily armed cavalrymen as an escort. The great names were scattered from Nagagris on the edge of the great desert to Iothea on the Sempus Delta, and Scorus had landed raiders on the north bank to harry them. Risking death or capture, clearing up a matter such as this, wouldn't do. So far, the problem of Anassarimber Kellis remained more theoretical than practical. As his attendants fetched his horse, the exalt general looked for Martimus, found him milling among the troopers. Martimus had always preferred the company of common soldiers to that of officers, something that Confis had once thought quaint, but now found annoying, even seditious.
Martimus, what's happened to you?
Confis mounted his black and rode over to him. The taciturn general watched him, apparently without apprehension. Like a Skilvendi, Confis spat on the earth beneath the shod hooves of Martimus's horse. Then he glanced back at Proyas's pavilion, at the embroidered eagles splayed in black across the weathered white canvas, and at the guards who eyed him and his men suspiciously. The eagle and tusk pennant of House Nersey lolled in the lazy breeze, framed by the faint escarpments of the south bank. He turned back to his wayward general. "It appears," he said in a fierce voice that wouldn't carry, "that you aren't the only casualty of this spy's sorcery, Martimus. When you kill this warrior prophet, you'll be avenging many, very many."